This is Point of Inquiry for Friday, November 2008.
Welcome to Point of Inquiry. I'm DJ Grothy. Point of Inquiry is the radio show and the podcast of the Center for Inquiry, a think tank advancing reason, science, and secular values in public affairs and at the grassroots. Before we get to this week's guest, here's a word from Skeptical Inquirer magazine.
Where can you turn to find others like yourself who appreciate critical thinking? Turn to Skeptical Inquirer, the magazine that separates fact from media myth. It's published by the Committee for Skeptical Inquiry. Find out what genuine science has to say about the extraordinary and the unexplained. You'll be surprised. Subscribe to Skeptical Inquirer today. 1 year, 6 challenging issues for $19.99. To subscribe or request a sample issue, just call 1-800-634-1610 or visit the Point of Inquiry website, pointofinquiry.org.
I'm happy to have James McGahey on Point of Inquiry. He's a retired United States Air Force pilot, an astronomer, and he's director of the Grasslands Observatory in Arizona. He's held a top-secret compartmented security clearance and was involved in numerous classified operations, including operations in the so-called Area 51. His current work includes astronomy and photometry of asteroids and supernovae. He's discovered 15 asteroids and 52 comets and has over 1,700 citations in the scientific literature on near-Earth asteroids. He's the winner of the 2002 Shoemaker NEO grant, and he's actively promoted science and debunked pseudoscience for over 35 years. He's the founder and chairman of the Tucson Skeptics and a scientific consultant for the Committee for Skeptical Inquiry. Welcome to Point of Inquiry, James McGahey.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here today.
James, you're one of the leading skeptical experts on UFOs in the world. Before we get to some of the claims about UFOs that are out there, why don't you tell me how you got into all of this? You know, you're not born being a UFO skeptic.
No, that is absolutely correct. I started as an amateur astronomer when I was 12 years old and my interest in science. And what really led me to this, I was never particularly interested in it because I always knew that it made no rational sense and the reports had no evidence to support them. But over the years, as more and more people ask the question, they always ask two simple questions when you tell them you're an astronomer or an amateur astronomer. Do you believe in UFOs? And what is your sign? And as a result of that, I got very interested in investigating UFOs and in taking a look at the irrationality of astrology.
Hmm. And from that, it kind of led to you, you know, you've appeared widely in the media. You're kind of giving the scientific, the skeptical take on these UFO claims.
That's correct. I was very interested in trying to look at it from a scientific perspective. What is actually the evidence to support these very diverse and wild type claims about UFOs and generally about the idea that they were visitors from outer space?
Are you open-minded in the least? Do you at least allow for the possibility that we could be being visited by UFOs, by flying saucers?
Yes, I am. And this is what distinguishes UFOs from astrology. It is possible, although very difficult, that an alien civilization could exist somewhere in our galaxy and they have developed the technology to actually travel to the Earth. It is not very likely. It would be very difficult on their part to do it, but it's not impossible. Some things in pseudoscience, such as astrology, simply are impossible because they violate the laws of physics and therefore, within a scientific framework, cannot be true. Certainly, certain aspects of UFOlogy and UFOs violate the laws of physics. And I should say, when I'm speaking of UFOs, I'm talking about alien spacecraft from another world. UFO, of course, is meant and was coined by the early director of Project Blue Book, Unidentified Flying Object. It's a terrible term in the sense that what was actually being reported was things in the sky that simply were unknown, whereas Unidentified Flying Object sort of implies intelligent control.
Yeah, most people, when they hear UFO, they think alien spacecraft. They don't think just something that's unidentified.
That's correct. And that's although some UFO believers will try to make a point of, well, maybe we're just referring to objects, we don't know what they are. The only thing that's interesting about the subject, really, is if indeed they are spacecraft from another world.
But the point here is that you are open-minded. You've just, in your years of investigating, never found evidence to warrant belief.
Absolutely. In a scientific sense, you have to be open to the idea that they're possibly one of these cases is actually a real spacecraft from another world. There certainly has been no evidence to support this, and of course, a lot of scientific thought that goes counter to the idea that it's likely to occur.
James, let's get into some of the history of UFOlogy, ufology, I guess they call it. Despite what some alternative historians say, people have not been talking about UFOs for all of human history. It's kind of just a 20th century phenomenon, right?
That is true. It really more or less started in about 1945. There was some precursors to it in science fiction before that, and I might add science fiction has been a big promoter of this in popular culture and has contributed to it in a great deal of the fervor in the belief that has occurred in it. But it really has its beginnings with a science fiction magazine, and in particular a science fiction writer in 1945. The science fiction magazine was called Amazing Stories, and the editor of the magazine, Ray Palmer, who literally took sort of a science fiction story that had been sent in by a believer about mysterious aliens living under the ground on the Earth and occasionally coming out and flying their machines. And this was supposedly communicated to this person, Richard Schaefer, who had sent these stories in through his welding machine. He was a welder and a promoter of this idea. And then the editor, Ray Palmer, over a series of articles over the course of about 2 years, promoted this idea and helped develop many ideas that exist today in relationship to this, including concepts of government conspiracy and advanced technologies and threat to national security and extraterrestrial vehicles, all came out of this. And then what really began it was in June 24th, 1947, a private pilot flying an airplane in Washington State saw 9 particular objects over the mountains there in Washington and reported this, and Ray Palmer started a new magazine called Fate, and the very first issue, the spring of 1948, promoted this idea of Ray Palmer sightings. And this was one of the very first cases in the predecessor of Project Blue Book, Project Sign, which reported that he had seen these objects flying across the mountains there.
Sorry, who saw those objects? The pilot, not Ray Palmer.
Kenneth Arnold saw the objects, but Ray Palmer, the editor in a new magazine of Fate, was the one who promoted it. And a few years later, together, they would write a book about this.
So it's kind of a pop culture phenomenon with roots in sci-fi, but it's certainly not, except to us skeptics, science fiction these days. Instead, it's a widely held belief where people honestly feel like they've seen alien spacecraft. You mentioned kind of government conspiracy coming out of the Ray Palmer's sci-fi work at Fate and Amazing Stories. I hear from a lot of believers in aliens that, I guess everybody has a relative who saw a UFO once. A lot of these believers say that the government is covering this stuff up, that there's a massive cover up to keep the public ignorant of all of it. There's this thing called Project Blue Book. There's all the blacked out pages and other government documents. Believers argue that all of this is evidence of a cover up. Let's start with Project Blue Book. Tell me what that is.
Project Blue Book started as Project Sign in January of 1948, and then in February of 1949 it became Project Grudge, and then in March of 1952 it became Project Blue Book.
So these were government investigations of these sightings?
Not exactly government. It was an Air Force program based at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base to investigate claims that were made of objects in the sky that were unknown. The original concern in setting up the project was that perhaps they were some kind of secret military weapon the Soviets had deployed, and it fairly early on it became apparent that that wasn't the case. And over the years, over those 22 years, they took in over 12,000 reports, most of which were explained, a few of which were not, basically because of bad reporting and activities. But it's important to note that Blue Book was never bigger than a few people. At its biggest, it had about 12 people working on the project.
So it wasn't a massive government investigation?
No, it was never a massive government investigation. It was only, like I say, about 12 people at the max. Most of the time, it was only 6 people. And also, the highest it was ever classified was secret. It was never classified top secret or higher in classification. And so it was a program that was continued to basically ensure there wasn't a threat to national security, basically from the Soviet Union.
So the concern was not that aliens were visiting us and that was a threat. The concern was that maybe these things people were seeing, were Soviet aircraft and that could be a threat.
Yes, the threat was perceived to be from the Soviet Union, not from aliens, and it was never technically a scientific program. It was just a program to ensure there wasn't a threat to national security.
Mm.
And once the Air Force had commissioned a scientific report that was conducted at the University of Colorado from about 1966 to 1968.
That's the Condon Report?
That is the famous, now called the Condon Report. Its actual title is the Final Report of the Scientific Study of Unidentified Flying Objects.
Mm.
But it's commonly called the Condon Report. And once that report was commissioned and they did an investigation for 2 years and found that there was no threat to national security, and in fact, they found that there was no advanced technology involved in any of these sightings, no threat to national security, and certainly no extraterrestrial vehicles. They did state that it might be worthy of further academic study, but only from a sociological and a psychological standpoint, not from a physical object standpoint.
In other words, to explore why people believe this stuff despite there being little actual evidence.
That is correct. They were totally interested, thought that that would be the only thing worthwhile, and the Air Force, because it wasn't a threat to national security, closed the program in December of 1969, and since 1969, the Air Force has not investigated UFOs.
Mm.
In fact, not only does it not investigate it, UFOs, it does not even take reports of UFOs.
Despite the conspiracy theories to the contrary, the government is not in the business of UFO investigations.
I can't say the government, because I, as a retired Air Force pilot, I was very familiar with what the Air Force does, but to best of my knowledge, and I held the highest security clearance you can hold, I never saw any evidence that I know the United States Air Force doesn't, And to the best of my knowledge, after 1969, nothing in the government that I'm aware of was ever commissioned to investigate UFOs. Mm.
When you were talking about Project Blue Book, and I also know the same is true for the Condon Report, there were unsolved cases. There were cases that were looked into, and the investigators couldn't really comment one way or the other. The believers in UFOs used those unsolved mysteries as evidence that there was something really going on, you know, some alien presence actually visiting us.
Well, they do indeed do that, but of course when you consider how inaccurate and how flawed human perception is, and that's basically all these cases were anecdotal stories of people saying they saw something. The fact that they're not reporting accurately what they actually saw, and in some cases, of course, there were fraud involved. The number of cases that were actually reported to Blue Book were actually fraud that was trying to be committed. But it's not surprising that 5% of the cases would not be explainable simply because of the lack of accurate data and the inaccuracy of human perception. If you're looking at it from a scientific standpoint and you're trying to look at statistical significance of investigating something, 5% is insignificant.
Mm. So lack of an explanation for a sighting is not itself an explanation that it was a UFO.
This report is totally inaccurate. The person reported very poorly, or they didn't give enough information that we can make an accurate assessment of what it might have been, or of course it could have been due to some natural rare phenomena that would be very difficult to assess with just an eyewitness testimony.
Can't you see, though, to the believer, how what you just said seems so insufficient? You know, someone who knows for a fact that aliens are among us, they're visiting us on a daily, weekly, monthly basis, whatever, and they hear a skeptic say, well, these things are unexplained, therefore we have to withhold judgment. Well, that's just not very satisfying.
Well, perhaps it's not satisfying to a believer, but then again, a believers believe for all kinds of various reasons psychologically, and they're not, that doesn't bother me at all. You have to ask the question a different way. Is there any evidence that alien spacecraft are visiting the Earth today? And the answer is no. There is no empirical evidence that that is occurring, and there is no evidence that ever has been assessed. So what you're saying is, when you say something like that, is you're saying that I believe this, therefore, you should go out and find some evidence to support my belief. There simply is no evidence to support this idea. And until there is evidence, and this is, of course, one of the reasons that the scientific community has never been very interested in this subject, is the fact that there is no evidence. Mm. And the scientific community really has a very negative attitude about this whole UFO phenomenon.
The scientific community is interested in evidence one way or the other, and since there's a complete lack of evidence, you're saying it makes it an uninteresting question to the vast majority of scientists.
That is correct, and there's nothing. This is very much a will-o'-the-wisp kind of phenomena in which almost all of the reports are nothing but anecdotal stories with nothing to support this person's story. Mm. So how do you investigate that? You could investigate whether the person is sociologically or psychologically stable. You can investigate whether they are have some kind of illness or something. But to investigate what they actually claimed, all you have is their statement, which is not corroborated by anything.
Well, you have all kinds of other lines of evidence too, don't you? You have photographic evidence. You have videographic evidence. In this context, let's talk about the Phoenix Lights, okay? You're from Arizona, so you were there for all the publicity surrounding this widely reported sighting of UFOs there in the Phoenix area. What's the scoop on the Phoenix Lights from your point of view?
The Phoenix Lights is a classic classical case of where something really did occur in the sky, but was totally misinterpreted. It occurred on 13 March 1997. A number of people in the Phoenix, Arizona area saw lights in the sky. These lights made no sound. Many people claim that the series of lights, which was, depending on the timing of it, was either nine lights or five lights. They claimed they connected the dots and made all the lights edged lights on a big object a mile across. Many people said it must be a UFO. That's what the claims were at the time.
Right. I've seen the video online, and there was a Peter Jennings special recently, another special on ABC. They don't seem like aircraft flying in formation, which is what some skeptics say. It seemed like one big aircraft slowly moving across Phoenix, and it was very eerie, and, you know, I see why people say, wow, I saw aliens or an alien spacecraft.
Well, first off, all they saw was lights in the sky. You're making a giant leap of faith to say this is one object, and then you're making an even more grotesque leap of faith to claim it's an alien spacecraft. But let's look at what this truly was. It's important to note on this case that two different sets of lights were seen that night, one at 8:30 and one at 10:15. The one that is mostly seen on the video, where there's perhaps a dozen videos of it, is the 10:15 lights that form this V-looking formation low in the sky. That is what most people think of when they see the Phoenix lights. The story behind the Phoenix lights is quite clear. At 8:30, the lights that came over Phoenix was a formation of military aircraft with their formation lights on, which is makes aircraft flying in formation quite different looking in the sky. They flew over Phoenix. They were seen by a few people, and only one video clip exists of the 8:30 lights. It is clear that they took off out of Las Vegas, out of Nellis Air Force Base, because there are reports of this formation of five lights coming down from Henderson, Nevada, and the Superstition Mountains, and Paul in Arizona before they get over Phoenix. And to make it more compelling, there was an amateur astronomer in Phoenix that night who happened to put his large telescope on and saw, they looked at this five lights in a V formation, and clearly they were aircraft. Mm. What you see on videotape most of the time is the 10:15 lights. These lights were a couple of A-10s flying on a range that was about 150 miles away from Phoenix. And if they were ready to go home that night, and they had nine flares, a very particular kind of flare that's designed to illuminate a circle on the ground about a mile across, and they put out about 2 million candle power. They're so bright that at 150 miles, they're as bright as Venus. So they dropped all of these nine flares at once and then went home, and this is clearly what you see on the video.
Mm. So here you've given this kind of skeptical explanation, kind of you debunked the whole Phoenix lights belief, right? But people will still continue believing that the Phoenix lights are ironclad proof of alien visitation of the planet Earth. James, how do you get through to people who have unshakable conviction that they just saw a UFO, or that they've seen the video of the Phoenix lights, and despite what you, skeptic with an agenda, and maybe you're a government agent or something, you know, a disinformation guy. What do you say to people who believe despite the evidence?
If they believe in despite the evidence, there's not much you can say, because what they're doing is admitting that their belief is irrational, and they're going to believe it in spite of what the evidence says, and it doesn't make any difference to them.
So you would just call anyone who doesn't believe in the explanation you just gave, you just kind of dismiss them as being irrational?
If someone has the evidence for any particular case, in this case we're talking about the Phoenix lights, and still continues to believe that this is an alien spacecraft, when all it was seen in the sky was nine lights and five lights, then that is simply totally irrational. Mm. It is without ability. There is nothing rationally you can say about that. If you look at that and say, first off, even if I hadn't said anything about what these lights were, they were just lights, nine lights and five lights. It is an incredible leap of irrationality to go from that to saying this is an alien spacecraft from another world. And that is, after all, what is interesting to these people. Remember, the evidence is not just what I've said. That night, you can look at the videotape and clearly see the lights are not a solid object, because the lights move in respect to each other. There was no radar reports that night of the nine lights, because they were 150 miles away and there were flares.
Right.
The five lights that flew over Phoenix, and they were flying at altitude, was not reported on radar as well, because they were flying under visual conditions and they were flying above the terminal control area, which is the area around dense airports, and as a result, they wouldn't even have been, they perhaps would have been on radar, but they would have been unnoticed because they weren't in the airspace that was being controlled.
Mm. What you were getting at is that people are going to believe despite the evidence.
Absolutely. People believe in spite the evidence, and this is true of all belief in paranormal claims. Belief itself is an incredibly complicated psychological phenomena involving many, many different things. But when someone truly wants to believe something is true, then no amount of evidence is going to change their mind to that. And because it becomes part of their worldview, it becomes part of their psyche in a way that is difficult to break down, because in some sense, it's the house of cards that makes up their life. And once you take one of those cards out and say, well, this is not true, then that whole house of cards comes tumbling down.
Well, and that kind of fills you with existential dread. If you're really invested in this worldview that says aliens are visiting us and they have this great plan for the future of humanity, they'll solve our problems, then you say, no, ain't no such thing, then that throws their whole kind of comforting worldview into question.
Yes, it absolutely does. It is a worldview, and of course this has, when you go into the areas of belief, this gets into areas where things get really quite complicated, involving the ideas of hope and salvation, and trying to counteract the ideas of basically doom, salvation versus doom, good versus evil, hope versus fear, order versus chaos. These are things that people put in their worldview to help them in a very chaotic world, that humans simply do not like disorder and chaos, and they will come up with ways to combat that, and one of them is believing in things that sort of have this hopeful idea in it, and ufology is certainly one of those.
Hmm. James, I want to finish up with the question of significance. You mentioned earlier about how many scientists don't consider these questions to merit their attention. So let me ask you, as you know, kind of a renowned skeptic of these claims, what does it really matter if people believe this UFO stuff, if it fills them with the kind of hope you were just talking about? Even though you think it's nonsense, it seems to kind of serve a purpose in their lives. Further, aren't these questions kind of trivial? You know, if you're tilting against windmills, you're going out trying to argue people out of their belief in UFOs, aren't there bigger questions facing our species that rationally minded people should be setting themselves to?
Well, again, the social ideas, the social fabric of society has to be based on rationality and being able to know what is true and what is not true. One of the things that it certainly has been ongoing with the flying saucer myth is that It's a living myth and a changing myth. And it's changing in very bizarre ways. It has evolved into conspiracy about governments, about ruling powers, about grays interacting with the government in inductions, about cover-ups by government and science and the news media. And this all breeds distrust in institutions and society.
Right. There's a really weird intersection of religion, conspiracy theory, and ufology. You know, the belief that not only are aliens among us, but our ruling class, our ruling elite are aliens themselves, lizard people or something, and the government's covering it up, and it's all some attempt to control, you know, the peons, the ordinary everyday Joe. And you're saying that sort of belief leads people to not be as good a citizen as, you know, we all want us to be.
Yes, that's true. And of course, the myth has become more and more bizarre and darker over the years. And it's gotten to the point not only of being irrational about believing this, but it's become more and more, this conspiracy ideas have led more and more to widespread rejection of science and technology and to the rejection of analytical thinking. And that evil forces are actually manipulating everywhere institutions of government, society, and so forth. And humans that are looking for order out of this are simply looking in the wrong place. This is a bankrupt idea to think that somehow meaning can come from the sky, which has been a overriding issue, you know, if you think about gods coming from the sky and salvation coming from the sky. This is an old thing, but this is basically the flying saucer myth is basically a space age mythology, which has an ongoing and living and changing nature to it that is day by day becoming more and more bizarre and darker in its feelings, and people are becoming more and more distrustful of institutions because of it.
Mm. Thank you very much for our discussion, James McGahey.
Thank you very much, DJ. I enjoyed it very much.
You've seen the headlines. Bill seeks to protect students from liberal bias. The right time for an Islamic reformation. Kansas school board redefined science. These stories sum up the immense challenge facing those of us who defend rational thinking, science, and secular values. What one advisor to the Bush administration dismissed as the reality-based community. Who could have imagined that reality would need defenders? The educational and advocacy work of the Center for Inquiry is more essential than ever, and your support is more essential than ever. Show your commitment to science, reason, and secular values by becoming a friend of the Center today. Whether you are interested in the work of PsyCop and Skeptical Inquirer magazine, the Council for Secular Humanism and Free Inquiry magazine, the Commission for Scientific Medicine, or Center for Inquiry on campus, by becoming a friend of the Center, you'll help strengthen our impact. If you're just learning about CFI, take a look at our website, www.centerforinquiry.net. We host regional and international conferences, college courses, and nationwide campus outreach. You'll also find out about our new representation at the United Nations and important national media appearances. We cannot pursue these projects without your help. Please become a friend of the Center today by calling 1-800-818-7071 or visiting www.centerforinquiry.net. We look forward to working with you to enlarge the reality-based community.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Point of Inquiry. To get involved with an online conversation about today's episode, go to our online discussion forums at centerforinquiry.net/forums. Views expressed on Point of Inquiry aren't necessarily the views of the Center for Inquiry nor its affiliated organizations. Questions and comments on today's show can be sent to feedback@pointofinquiry.org or by visiting our website, pointofinquiry.org.
Point of Inquiry is produced by Thomas Donnelly and recorded from St. Louis, Missouri. Executive producer is Paul Kurtz. Point of Inquiry's music is composed for us by Emmy Award-winning Michael Quayle. Contributors to today's show included Sarah Jordan and Debbie Goddard. I'm your host, DJ Grothy.